Because I think it's important as VCs, it's important. I mean, I'm, of course, a global investor. So for me, it's part and parcel of my life. But I think generally, people need to be a lot more aware of what's going on in different parts of the world, because we're connected. Obviously, this pandemic has shown it in multiple ways, but we're connected in more ways than we think. Not just at the human level, but even at the business, at the investment level. So I think it's important. I think there's a gap there for somebody to really, you know, tap into for the US market.
Hello, and welcome to Drinks with a VC, episode 2. Thanks for tuning in from whatever platform you are using. I am Vic LaQuara, co-founder and managing director of Green Cow Venture Capital, and I'm joined by my friend and co-hostess with the mostess, Bree Hansen, who leads business development for Berkeley & Associates.
Thanks, Vic. Before we start the show, two disclaimers. The first disclaimer is that this is not your typical venture podcast. We assume that you, the listener and the viewer, can Google things like stage, industry, focus, average check size, etc.
Yeah, our goal is to let loose and shake things up a bit. And in the process, get to know the person behind the yes or the no investment decisions. We'll even touch on some hot button topics and current events, and of course, get insights and opinions from our guests on where they think we're all heading.
The second disclaimer is yes, guests and interviewers do consume alcoholic beverages during the taping of this show. We do so responsibly and ask that everyone do so as well. On that note, let's get started.
Can you believe it? Episode 1 is under our belts and we haven't been canceled. How does it feel?
Oh, there's still time.
Yeah, true. We'll make an effort. Are you as charged up about the next guest as I am?
Absolutely. He's beyond impressive.
I am really excited. It's so great to have yet another eclectic, talented, passionate individual. I have so much that I want to ask him. So let's just get right to it. Mohanjit Jolly is a partner at Iron Pillar, an Indian-focused growth stage fund. He has 23 years of operational and investment experience. Most recently, he spent 9 years at DFJ, where he established their India operations and oversaw their India venture portfolio. Prior to that, he was handpicked by Guy Kawasaki himself to be a partner at Garage Technology Ventures. He also worked with Caltech and JPL to launch a technology incubator called Via Space. He holds an MBA from UCLA and a bachelor's and master's from MIT in aeronautics and astronomics engineering. Please welcome the only rocket scientist on this podcast, Mohanjit Jolly. MJ, it's so great to have you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's an honor to be on this platform with you, Vic and Bree. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Let's start with a drink. Okay, Macallan 18, why did you choose this scotch?
Well, so a little bit of history. I actually did not drink until I was, I believe, a junior in college. Still makes me an underage drinker, but I had not tasted anything. I grew up very sheltered. So my first drink, being in a fraternity, was beer. And I started, initially didn't like it, then I started loving it, and I became actually a brewer. And I used to give tours at the Sam Adams Brewery in the Boston area way back when. Fast forward, when I came back to the US after a stint in India, my friends exposed me. They said, look, to wine. And they said, you're in the neighborhood of Napa, Calistoga, Sonoma, et cetera. You've got to get into wine. So, you know, I experiment a little bit with primarily reds, cabs, and pinots. But then when we launched Iron Pillar, my entire partnership was, typical Indian folks, and those in the audience or viewers who understand sort of the Indian, especially Indian male makeup, you know, single malt is the way to go. So they all would just have single malts all the time. And so over the last really 5 years, I have gotten accustomed to single malt as my drink of choice for a couple of reasons. One, you don't have to go back and forth to the bottle and make runs as you might do for beers and so on. So you just, you know, pour one, and depending on how much you want to nurse it, you nurse it. Macallan specifically is just a legendary brand. And I realize that in the spectrum of scotches, you can go from smooth to what's called very peaty or smoky. I'm not a big peaty smoky fan. I'm sort of somewhere in the middle. And Macallan is one that even if you've never had a scotch in your life, you can open up a bottle of a Macallan 18. It just goes down very, very smoothly without getting you, you know, all tipsy after, you know, a first couple of sips. And you can nurse it. You can nurse it. You can, if you want, you can add some soda. You can add a couple of, you know, bits of ice to it. I like it neat, which is, you know, straight up, if you will. And I like sipping it while I'm reading a good book or binge watching Netflix or whatever I'm doing, or getting, you know, getting my financials in order and talking to the missus late at night. That's really when I need, you know, single malt. So that's the reason for Macallan specifically. It's just a brilliant brand and it goes down smooth.
I feel like that's a walking advertisement for Macallan. This is great. Absolutely. Product placement.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm willing to order some swag if the distillery would let me have it.
Well, yeah, speaking of swag, you opened up our pregame gift ahead of time, which was partly the Macallan 18, but it was also a glass that you're drinking it out of.
Yes.
Brie.
Yes, I know from personal experience, MJ, you have pretty much a library full of shot glasses from your trips around the world. So we almost got you a shot glass, but we figured you already had enough. Most people abandon their shot glasses in their college years, but you have kept quite the collection. So do you want to tell us a little bit about your shot glass collection?
Of course, of course. So look, the deal I have with the missus is, and I'm a collector, by the way. I collect all sorts of little tchotchkes, and I can talk some more about that. But the deal I have with Vinny, my much better half, is I can collect things as long as it doesn't cost a lot and it doesn't occupy much space. So everything I have in terms of collections can either be put in a box or be, you know, displayed on a shelf. And so shot glasses, you know, I just realized I love to travel. I've always loved to travel. I've been to all 50 states. I've been to, you know, 60 plus countries. And I always, you know, try to pick up something, again, small, that's easily transportable. If I look at it, it immediately triggers a memory in my mind. And what better way to do it than a shot glass? And the reality is I've actually had some sort of alcohol out of each one of those 350 glasses that I have in my collection today. So
one for day of the year.
But thankfully it was over decades. So it's not as if, you know, I destroyed my liver in 1 year.
It's not a collection of dead brain cells then, is what you're saying.
Well, I'm sure there would be more brain cells had I not imbibed across 350 shot glasses. But yeah, it's just the, you know, little memories. So that and refrigerated magnets are two very location specific collections, you know, that I have. So if you look at, we have two fridge refrigerators, as a typical Indian family does, one in the garage, one in the house, and the garage fridge is the one that's just completely full of magnets, and I can actually have the kids tell me, hey, you remember when, and then they'll, you know, rattle off a bunch of little anecdotes that they still remember from our travels.
That's awesome.
So you've lived all over the place, you've traveled all over the world. What place has left the biggest mark and impacted your life the most?
Well, I think, I mean, I have to say India. And so just a little bit of history. So I was born there. You know, I was a 13-year-old when I moved, or the family moved to the States. And so I did my high school and college and everything. And then I did have a chance, as you said in the intro, with DFJ specifically in 2007 to move to India and set up DFJ's operations and run it for 5 years. And so the kids at the time, when we moved there, three kids were 6, 4, and 1.5. And there was a very specific reason, and it sort of weaves into the question you just asked. There was a very specific reason to move from Silicon Valley to Bangalore in 2007. The reason was, of course, on the professional front, I could help catalyze, you know, the venture ecosystem that was just starting to develop in India. And I feel I did contribute to that over those 5 years. But just as importantly, you know, I feel, and I still feel, especially in this pandemic, I feel like we live here in Silicon Valley in what I call the fifth order bubble, right? So the US is a bubble. You got two bodies of water on either side. You've got California, which most of the 49 states don't quite understand. You've got Northern California, Silicon Valley, and Sand Hill Road, or Foothill Expressway, or whatever, you know, street you want to choose. So that's the fifth order bubble. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like it was time, and it was the opportunity of a lifetime for my wife and I to take our kids, and especially in these formative years, to expose them to what the real world is all about. And we talk about, you know, sitting here, you know, changing the world, but I think many people who talk about changing the world actually don't know what the world is really all about. So I just said, you know, what better way to do it than to actually immerse oneself in it and live there. So I would say those 5 years, through the ups and downs and through, you know, the bait and switches and expectations being high and then being thrown to the floor like a typical, you know, transient in India is like, that was, you know, life-changing, not only for me and my wife, but especially for the kids. So I think, you know, that's where, you know, yes, we lived in this, a friend of mine calls it the non-resident Indian ghetto. It looks like Orange County, right? You got rows of fantastic homes and palm trees and these orange, you know, sort of Portuguese roofs, but you step right outside that gate and boom, you know, the sounds and the smells and the visions are right there. And so when we were in Bangalore, we adopted a slum that was right outside. We adopted a school for the blind and an orphanage. So we basically said, we're going to do whatever we can to, you know, to impact. And the kids were actually at the forefront as young as they were. And so they still have those memories. And my hope is, and only time will tell whether, you know, that actually has or had an impact as they, you know, they are young adults now and as they go on with their lives. So I would say those 5 years in Bangalore, just kind of dealing with the ups and downs and hopefully having an impact on others was probably the most impactful, you know, for me personally.
So where do you think is your must go to place after COVID?
Must go to place after COVID. You know, believe it or not, I've actually never been to either Australia or New Zealand, even though I've been, you know, most places in Europe and even parts of Africa and Latin America, not been to ANZ, as they call it. And I'd love to go, especially, I guess, New Zealand, because everything I hear about the place before they really shut it down for any future, you know, travel and keeping that sort of pristine environment intact. I'd love to be able to do that. I'm not a very religious guy, but I'm a very spiritual guy. So mountains, water, nature, you know, those things actually have a fantastic impact on me and lifts my spirit. So, you know, doing so in a place that I've never been would be fantastic.
Well, we know you're itching to travel after quarantine, so we're going to start our VC unboxing segment where our VC guest opens up one of the pre-delivered boxes, or bags in this case, yep, for a fun surprise. So please open bag number one.
All right. For everybody, this is bag number one. Oh my goodness. All right. I love it.
So I will describe, because I know there are some people who may be listening at home. He pulled out some LED sunglasses or some glasses with some lights, and he has a vest there. Let's see the vest. What does the vest say on it?
It says Mojo.
Yes.
Which happens to be one of my several stage names or nicknames that have been given. I'm assuming you got it embroidered, or did you find it this way? This is remarkable. Thank you.
No, this is a one of a kind vest. So every VC on our show, since you are an investor, we get you a vest. One that's one of a kind just for you, because we don't want you going to a conference or Burning Man with another vest that someone else is wearing. That's the most embarrassing thing that can happen, is showing up to a South by Southwest party with the same vest as someone else.
True that. By the way, Burning Man, I have never been to, so that's definitely one of the places I will visit.
We know. We don't know if Vinny's going to let you go, but if she lets you go.
This is awesome. All right.
You should absolutely pair that with some tights, spandex, a tutu. It is all fair game.
Yeah, what would be your Burning Man outfit? I would like to hear about your what your wardrobe would be.
So I have long, very curly hair. So as a Sikh, we're not supposed to cut our hair. And so even though I've got a little bit of a receding hairline, I've got long, curly hair. So I don't need much in terms of sort of the hairdo, if you will. The LED lights on these glasses are fantastic. I do have spandex pants that I bought for a party, never used. And I have a leopard, leopard skin jacket, I guess you would call it. Again, never worn. So I'm just going to pull all of that together. And my guess is the one place where I will not be sort of scrutinized is probably Burning Man. So I'm looking forward to taking all the things that I've been saving in my small closet that have never been worn, and put it all together. And maybe as a follow up, I'll do a selfie and send it to you guys. You can use it as an add on.
You better put the glasses on.
I do need to put the glasses on. If they fit under the turban, that's always a little bit of a tricky situation. It's a very small market.
You can just hold them up so we can, get, because I liked the Elton John look. I felt like that kind of had, and then they're programmable with an app as well. So I wanted you to be able to color coordinate with your outfits during the day and night, because you're going to be wearing that jacket on those cold playa nights.
This is the ultimate way to accessorize the turban.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Can I just do the rest of it with?
There you go. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right. Let me see if I can. Oh, darn it. My computer does not have a USB port. It's one of the new Apples. So I can't. But let me see if the battery is charged.
For the viewers of the podcast, I think they're going to get enough of a glimpse into what the future might hold for you at Burning Man. And that's the goal.
All right.
If Vinny approves of you going to Burning Man.
Speaking of Vinny, I know you guys have kind of a fun How I Met Your Mother story. You guys met on the job. You want to tell us a little bit about how you met your wife?
Yeah, it's just like my entire life, quite honestly. It seems to be a set of coincidences and accidents, if you will. So I was in business school, this is 96 fall, and half a dozen of us techie types, we decided, what the hell, let's rent a Winnebago, and we can crash in it, we don't need a hotel, and let's just go and visit a bunch of tech companies. So this was, Excite at Home, and Yahoo had just gone public or was about to go public, and 3Com happened to be one of the companies on the list, because one of the guys had a connection. So in we go, we get chaperoned in, actually into the boardroom, when Eric Benemu, the CEO of 3Com at the time, is in the middle of a board meeting as these, six, you know, first year MBA students from UCLA walk right in. I think we must have broken, you know, N number of SEC rules and regulations right then and there. And then there's, you know, the CEO of FedEx and Pac Bell and whoever else was on the board at the time. And there was just this awkward silence. And then Eric, you know, very nicely talked about some other stuff that was obviously not sensitive, just to kind of fill the minute until he gave our chaperone the wink that, okay, it's enough. Let's get these guys out. So we did. And then it was in the cafeteria where I saw Vinny. She was a marketing manager at 3Com at the time. And the way I could tell that she was a Sikh, again, long hair and a stainless steel, typically it could be a metal bracelet in the right hand. And I just went for it and like, hey, this is who I am. How are you? And that started, I guess it was almost a 1.5 year long, you know, long distance sort of relationship. I would drive my little Acura hatchback up I-5 almost every weekend. It's wow. Amazing. I actually passed, first year of business school. And I proposed to her at the stroke of midnight, 1997, 1998. At Half Moon Bay on the beach, where of course I was there illegally. And we were not supposed to be there. So I've been breaking rules all my life. And now of course it's out for the public to consume. And then we got engaged in March when I still remember Vinny's extended families to their distress. Here's a guy who is unemployed, right? So his second year of business school, who's unemployed, who's got loans from MIT that he has not paid. He's got additional loans from UCLA that he's going to have to pay. Mm. And why in the world would you get your daughter married to an unemployed guy with a ton of liability? So I had to sort of go through a bunch of interviews during the engagement, party. I just, people probing like, okay, so, you know, what is your pro forma like? What are you going to be worth? What are you going to do? Maybe not in that much detail, but... Yeah, so, you know, and then we got married in November of 98. So that's 2 years after I met her, completely by accident in the cafeteria.
Well, when your son gets married, if he needs a CFO to prepare his income statements for his fiance's parents, I've got a guy.
That may be a separate line of business there. I got it. Excellent.
Indian matchmaking.
Especially pro forma. For the Indians. Yes. I love it.
So I, like you, was a little bit of a rebellious young Indian male that spent a lot of time and grew up in California. I hear that you love Tupac maybe as much as I do. Is that correct?
That's right. West Side.
He's throwing up the West Side sign. I know he's legit. All Eyes on Me was probably the first album that I remember memorizing and listening to ad nauseum. I have a little bit of a hypothetical for you. Come around here in a second, but let's say Tupac is still alive today and he throws his support behind a candidate or a cause that you strongly disagree with. Hmm. Would you stop listening to Tupac?
Brilliant question. You know, it's interesting you ask that question because we've had a similar conversation. So I'll come back to answering the question directly in a minute. But we've had a similar conversation with our oldest, who is a big Chris Brown fan, and so as a musician, the guy's a legend, but as an individual, he's had some issues, and so at least Vinny and I have struggled. Do we look purely on the you know, on the music or the artist or the gift that this individual has? Or do we need to, you know, really think about this as a person, because that person's actually having an impact on, in this case, our child or our children? So in that particular scenario, we erred on the side of the complete individual, just because I think, you know, art, while somebody may be incredibly gifted, if they have the influence and the magnification, amplification across millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people, and that in some way, shape or form breeds divisiveness, or breeds, you know, kind of behavior that I simply am not okay with at any level, then I think it's hard for me to appreciate that individual, right? Now, to go back to Tupac, look, I mean, just taking the 2020 example or the last 4 years example, I'm not a big fan of the current president. Now, if one were to come to me and say, look, you know what? I know he's not a good individual, but I don't want to pay as much in taxes. Or, you know, I like this sort of America first approach, and look at the data, you know, what has, you know, what he has accomplished and so on. I can dig it, right? I can get into a civil conversation to say, okay, I get it that you're, you know, for him because of these reasons. What my issue becomes, whether it's this, the you know, the president, or in Tupac's case, it's the moral compass issue, right? To me, a person is a person first, and anything else after that. So if that prerequisite, or if that person is by his or her behavior has sent a very strong signal that their morals or value system is very, very different than mine, then I have a very hard time, you know, overcoming that. Now, if Tupac were to say, hey, I like this particular person because of XYZ policies or XYZ data, and even though I may not agree with it, I may say, look, I want open immigration. And he says, you know what, we should only make immigration plausible for, you know, those who are going to add to the U.S. economy, because we want them to be masters and PhDs and what have you. I can sort of say, okay, I understand where you're coming from, because you have that data, but somebody who's, you know, doesn't have that moral character, doesn't have the value system, and is abusive or whatever the case may be, if that is indeed what Tupac stands for, or stands behind, then I think I'm gonna have trouble, just overcoming that. Yeah, I hope that answers the question.
You know, I ask because just as it's really hard to extricate an artist from their work entirely, and it's hard to just appreciate the work sometimes without also thinking about the artists behind that work. As investors, you know, because today between social media and mainstream media, the companies and the individuals that we back as investors are forced to, in a way, take a stand one way or another. And often they take stands in ways that we can't predict. And so, you know, my follow-up to that is just, you know, where is that line for you as an investor?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I think the line for me is sort of where, if you're going after, let's say, you know, social media today, right? So there's one school of thought that says, hey, it's a platform. So anyone who wants to say anything, it's free speech. We are the enablers. We're not taking a stand one way or the other. So from my standpoint, I don't prescribe to that particular argument. Again, for the same reason that I mentioned previously, because there's this amplification effect. So I think there have to be certain guardrails, right? What I'm hearing, you know, Dorsey and Zuckerberg and hopefully, you know, Pichai and Wojcicki and all these folks talking about is to understand, you know, things like hate speech, things like at least have a mechanism to be able to flag it, right? And then let people who are imbibing this content, you know, make their own decision. I mean, they're sort of striking a fine balance between being open yet at least identifying what may be very inflammatory or just untrue set of statements. I mean, that is one thing that I am very, very concerned about. And so, I watched the documentary, for example, The Social Dilemma, and Tim Kendall, former Facebook and Pinterest, and now he's got, his new thing called Moment, is a very good friend and was a former colleague at Garage. And so we've talked about this, where, my worry is, and I see it in my kids, there's no such thing as privacy. So privacy simply doesn't exist for many of the young folks, because the whole idea around social media is to get as many people to see you, and therefore no barriers and let it go. And I want to see how many likes and shares and blah, blah, blah I have. And then the other is, of course, how we're being programmed, or we're being trained, or we're being addicted to doing things a certain way and being glued to, our screens. I don't think we understand fully, what the downstream impact of these kinds of work streams is, of course, given the current pandemic as well. So I think, to answer your question more directly, there have to be certain sort of value pillars. And you say, okay, this is something that we are not going to do, or at the very least, we're going to flag as questionable, right? So there's a spectrum along which maybe you can have some check marks, but to not have any check marks is a no-no in my book. Look, there are certain things that that we won't touch, that I won't touch, certain sort of categories, but the enabling technologies, I mean, AI at a broad level is considered that. So on the one hand, it's very, very exciting. It's going from a differentiation factor to a hygiene factor. But at the same time, I am concerned that if this were to go, unchecked, what the eventual outcome ends up being. Which makes it tricky, by the way, for, in the venture business, of course, we're in the business of investing in something. We may not know what that may look like about 10 years downstream. We may not know what it looks like 2 or 3 years from now, right? And so the other part of the question that I grapple with, and I don't have a good answer for, is let's say you make an investment thinking you are investing in X.
Yep.
Right? And you throw enough smart people from around the world at it, and there's this fanning out effect or tangential effect, right? So let's call it a bowling pin analogy. You were going for that lead pin, and what you don't know is what the downstream impact is going to be in terms of the overall technology development. And so what you thought was going to be something for the benefit of humanity turns out to be completely opposite, 5, 6, 7 iterations downstream. So what do you do then, right? And you may not have a say at that point. You're, small potatoes on the board, and what do you do now? I've not been in that situation thus far, but I wouldn't be surprised if I find myself, in that conundrum. And I'll make the real-time decision, I guess, at that point. But that's something that does keep me up at night.
Then you can just invest in a time machine, go back in time, and then not make the decision, like a Terminator 2 kind of situation, or I don't know. I just,
No, but here's something, Bree. Here's something. So I am of the philosophy of no regrets, right? So what you do is you make a decision based on the data that you have right then and there, and the checks and balances and your own sort of, art and science and intuition sort of wrapped into, an Indian masala, and you say, okay, we're a go, right? And have those turned out to be, imperfect or incorrect? Absolutely. But given where I was at that time, would I have made a different decision? No. So I just say, you learn from it, obviously. Mm-hmm. Try not to make the same mistake. You try to make new mistakes. But try not to go back and say, I wish I could have, should have, would have. Yeah.
So I know you prescribe, and I've only known you for a short period of time, but I know you prescribe to the sentiment, good begets good, right? And I think, like me, you look at the Silicon Valley bubble and where we are as sort of like this uber meritocracy, right? I was reading a article the other day that was particularly around India's caste system and how it's ruining Silicon Valley. And to paraphrase the author, basically says that despite this uber meritocracy, you know, the caste system and some of the stigmas associated and propagated from it continue here in Silicon Valley. And, you know, I think I personally know that I've been judged negatively based on by another brown person, right? Another Indian person. Not necessarily on a caste basis, but, you know, just purely on the color of my skin. Have you had experiences like that? Have you had any experiences with that?
Look, I've had plenty of experiences, generally speaking, given the way I look. I mean, I landed when we first moved to the country. Eventually, I mean, first landed in New York, but eventually ended up in South Central. And so South Central in the early 80s was a very, you know, it was Bloods and Crips killing each other. And there weren't that many Sikhs and turbaned, you know, kids around. So you can just imagine, you know, what life in the early weeks and months was like in the promised land, so to speak. And just, I mean, believe it or not, just in the last, it was a couple of months ago, I was walking, and typically what I do now during the pandemic is I don't do video calls. If I don't have to, I do what I call walk and talk. And so I do 25,000-30,000 steps sometimes because I'm just walking nonstop. And there, I'm sure there are several people on my street or on the major thoroughfare saying there's a turban bearded guy pacing, something bad is going to happen. I don't know what it is, but something bad is going to happen. But about, I guess, a month and a half, 2 months ago, you know, big truck, big American flag comes zooming by, slams on the brakes, flips me off and just says, you know, go back to wherever the expletive you came from. And so, you know, now this was Palo Alto, right? This is not, I'm not talking about, a rally somewhere in the Midwest or the South. It's just Palo Alto. And I was here, you know, post 9/11, and I had old, Caucasian ladies in downtown Palo Alto telling me, you effing Arab, go back to where you came from. So that part of me, those experiences have been there for the last 35 years. Okay. Now, specifically an Indian versus, Indian kind of, bigotry or bias. Maybe I'm oblivious, but at least I have not felt that directly. I guess I've got enough other people
worry about
off on a daily basis that compared to that, some of the maybe more nuanced bias is something I don't necessarily internalize or realize or pay a lot of attention to. And then look, you just. There are, relatively speaking, very few people who look like me. Definitely in the venture business, there are very few people who look like me. And there is, I'm assuming, some level of cognitive bias that exists in our community as well. And so the only way to overcome that is by, being yourself and doing the right thing, and hopefully others that you've impacted in a positive way speak well of you. And so if people hear about, Mohanjeet, MJ, Mojo, in a positive light from other people that they trust or they have interacted with or co-invested with, then you start to sort of chisel away at whatever that bias may be. At least, that's my approach, and I'm comfortable, with who I am.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's positive. I'll drink to that.
Yes.
Here, here.
Well, let's move on to gift number two so that we can keep things right. Flowing.
Number two, it is the blue bag with, let's see. All right, we've got a book. Sinclair Burquet, The Fire and the Darkness, The Bombing of Dresden. Amazing, amazing. This book, by the way, has been on my list of books to get and read. Thank you. Thank you for doing this, because I'm, as you are well aware, a big World War II fan, or not fan, but I'm very intrigued by different bits and pieces that led to it, and then what all happened along the way.
Yeah. What is it exactly about, you know, World War II that really fascinates you?
You know, I'm just a big history fan. So, yeah. You know, I love history. I love, you know, when I read, I tend to read more nonfiction than fiction, mm-hmm. just because I think many of the scenarios that one may think are brand new in our current environment, let's say, or the current world order. Mm-hmm. If one were to actually peel the onion and go back in time, you know, my guess is you would find, indications or aspects of what's happened today have clearly happened in the past. So I tend to, you know, really sort of understand what was going on in different parts of the world at a particular moment in time that led to a certain series of events. And I think, you know, you start looking at some of the events, during the Depression era or 30s in Europe, especially Germany, and the rise to power that Hitler had. Why was he able to? And it's, I mean, it's amazing. You look at Goebbels, and you look at the propaganda machine that he was. He was the social media single-handedly of the 30s and the 40s. I mean, he programmed the prefrontal cortex of a vast majority to think a certain way. They weren't even thinking for themselves. They were thinking as he was, you know, sort of prescribing them to think. And so you read that, and it's sent, and I would encourage everybody, I mean, there's a fantastic World War II series that has been digitally mastered on Netflix, and I've watched it twice. It's just remarkable how they slice and dice different major milestones, war in Europe and the Pacific, the atomic bomb, and so on, and really go through item by item what actually led to those events. And it actually made me shiver because of the similarities that I saw between what was going on, let's say, in the early 30s in Germany, and unfortunately a lot of the misinformation and disinformation that happens to be, you know, part and parcel of our 24-hour news channel here in the U.S. in 2020. It's absolutely remarkable and terrifying at the same time.
So I agree with you completely. That's crazy. There's a lot of parallels. I know a lot of VCs are history nuts. And is there anything that you're looking back on that's helping you anticipate for the future?
So look, I mean, I think I'm the penultimate optimist. Right. So the pessimist says the bad things always come, right? Because that's just the way world has been. There are just bad things come, bad characters come, things go to hell, people turn against each other, world wars have happened, civil wars have happened, and so on. I am on the other side of that abyss. And I say, look, good things happen, right? Because the right set of characters come in and see what mistakes have been made and try to sort of unify people rather than divide them and move forward. So even, you know, post-World War II, you know, whether it's the Marshall Plan or other sort of emergence of new, you know, world order, right? So 47, India got independence, Pakistan, Bangladesh, I mean, got independence. So World War II actually had an effect of then creating freedom or independence for many countries through the 40s and 50s. And that started a journey towards, eventual prosperity. So similarly in the VC business, we would talk about how incredible companies are created during the darkest periods, mm-hmm. you know, global financial crisis or the dot-com bubble bursting or I would imagine even during this pandemic, you know, 5 years downstream, we'll look back and say, oh my gosh, you know, this company was created that is now the next, you know, DoorDash or Airbnb or Facebook, you know, what have you. Yeah. But by the way, one other thing I should mention on the World War II stuff is being an aero-astro guy, I've always been a big fan of aircraft and airplanes. And so the real sort of fighter jets, if you will, and the British Spitfires and so on that really came into being and the air superiority or the air war really became a big part of the entire sort of 6 years was World War II. And so I got into it in two ways, one through the history angle, the other one was through, you know, looking at Jane's book. And Jane's is one of these Bibles of as much of a lover, not a fighter I am, I actually have been fascinated with war machines for some reason, ever since I was a child. So I've been reading up about, you know, aircraft from different eras and weapons of different eras. So when I go to, you know, UK, we go to the British Museum, you know, everybody else goes to see the mummies. I go to where the old imperial, you know, or medieval, you know, weapons are. And I just am fascinated with, you know, that aspect of it. So anyway, a little digression, but those are the two angles that got me into World War II.
So you love war tools and business tools, huh?
You know, it's sometimes there needs to be some weaponry or ammunition, as we call it, for our startups as well, to fight off competition. Not in the literal sense, but clearly, you know, you've got to have those devices.
I'd be remiss if I did not mention that we have another book that's heading your way that I think is going to be a surefire winner with you. So okay. Look forward to that. That's something to look forward to. Speaking of looking forward, Modi plastered the news in his support of Trump. And we've now sort of entered an era where we're making way for a new administration in the Biden-Harris administration. I'm really interested, as someone who is so cross-border in nature, the work that you do and the investments that you make, what does this change in administration mean for India, US, not just relations, but really, you know, technology, commerce, et cetera, between the two countries?
Look, so two ways to answer that question. One is, you know, Modi specific. So Modi is a prototypical politician, right? So what does a politician do? They have to be adaptable. They have to be flexible, almost bordering a chameleon in some cases, where because they don't know what the, you know, when the changing of guard is going to take place in another country, which happens to be a very, very close trading partner, let's say in this particular case. And he's going to be, he's aware of this. He knows that he'll have to work with Biden, even though there was a bromance going on, you know, with Trump because of a lot of the similar sort of ways of thinking, perhaps. I'm convinced, by the way, that the two of them have an early morning call and a late night call on speed dial. And they say, hey, what are you going to say tomorrow? And then what should I say, you know, tomorrow, and keep that 24/7 going. And maybe Bolsonaro is there too. Who the hell knows? So anyway, but I think fundamentally, though, there are certain massive tectonic shifts that are taking place, right? There's a whole sort of China filling the vacuum. I think, you know, what's incredible to me, and I was just speaking with a friend of mine in Singapore yesterday, and he said, it's amazing to me that the US has not spent as much time talking about the Ant Financial IPO being pulled and what ramifications that actually has on the broader sort of world order in terms of China and the government and Xi Jinping sort of coming in and saying, you know what, we're going to take those rails and try to make the world an RMB or a yuan centric or digital yuan centric, global system. Mm-hmm. Especially in the vacuum that's been created. Now, having said that, you know, Modi does have a make in India. It's a very India-centric philosophy, which I think in the scheme of things is a good thing. India has the the youngest demographic in terms of sheer population in the world. And so when you have millions of people coming into the workplace every single year, you've got to create this growth to be able to accommodate and not have the unemployment rate go through the roof. And so I think we need to move into technology, we need to move into manufacturing, we need to sort of bring in some of those skills and infrastructure investment, et cetera. And I would imagine, that the Biden-Harris, next 4 years are going to try and collaborate in terms of, some give and take, right? Some import, export, some, that trade will have to continue and will continue, because I think both entities have it in their best interest to work hand in glove, in part because of the China situation and Modi, because of, maybe because of Trump, but maybe because of the India first philosophy. Obviously, he's effectively stopped any Chinese investment in the country. He's taken a lot of the Chinese apps, off the Indian ecosystem. So clearly, there's a very strong message, that is being sent, and therefore he will need U.S. and he will need investments, whether it's from the U.S. Treasury or government or venture capital, to flow in to bridge that gap that has now been created because of the Chinese sort of departing. And they were very, very active in the Indian venture ecosystem.
Interesting. That's all new to me. That's kind of your guys's world.
The world is connected, Bree. I mean, that's the thing, right? So it's funny. I have my mom who came up from LA because I wanted her to be safe here. LA County, of course, is the hotbed of coronavirus right now. So her to go thing is she watches world news, right? And so she watches two things. She watches BBC News, and then she watches, I think, whatever it is, ABC News or something that's supposed to be world news. And her point to me was, they call it world news, but there's really nothing about the world that they talk about in the US.
You're totally right.
Yeah, you should talk about it, because I think it's important as VCs. It's important. I mean, I'm, of course, a global investor. So for me, it's part and parcel of my life. But I think generally, people need to be a lot more aware of what's going on in different parts of the world, because we're connected. Obviously, this pandemic has shown it in multiple ways, but we're connected in more ways than we think. Not just at the human level, but even at the business, at the investment level. So, yeah. I think it's important. I think there's a gap there for somebody to really tap into for the U.S. market.
Well, we want to move on from kind of this world global history onto more personal, going back to you and a little bit more about your life. Now, you were, this MIT guy who then decides to go to Mattel, which is a strange shift. So why don't we open up the next gift and...
Okay.
Let's...
So I'm going to number 3.
That's correct.
And be sure to give us the play-by-play here.
So okay, for those listening, he's opening up a bag. And what's in that bag?
It says Magic 8 Ball, Fortune Teller, Paperweight, Ornament, Conversation Piece. Wow.
So yes, this is one of the toys at your alma mater, your old company, Mattel.
Okay.
And we know you went over there to make, IoT. Is this your attempt at predictive analytics for toys?
No. It was, again, a complete accident, Bree. It was not by design at all. And as crazy as it may seem to have gone from MIT to Mattel, it's not quite as crazy as it may seem. So... this is fantastic, by the way. My eyesight is going, so I'm not quite sure if I should screw it off or open it another way. But let me answer your question while I'm trying to figure that out. So I was, how should I start this? So MIT, then I worked for 4 years for a defense contractor designing spy cameras for the military. I was part of the team that fixed the Hubble. And then went to UCLA, realizing I didn't have any business skills. I didn't want to sit behind an HP workstation doing finite element modeling and engineering work.
What? You know, that sounds exciting.
Yeah, so that's what I did. Yeah, I was. it was actually quite cool because this is a company that invented what are called piezoelectrics, and piezoelectrics are materials. If you pass a voltage through, they expand or contract depending on the voltage. And they built the largest telescopes in the world. So the large telescopes on Haleakala in Hawaii or down in Chile have these large mirrors, and the mirrors have to be pushed and pulled by these tiny piezoelectric motors, effectively to compensate for the the aberration in the atmosphere. Anyway, so I learned a ton there. But I started, there were 550 people. When I left, there were 110, because every 6 months we kept laying people off. So when the Democrats are in the White House, defense budgets get cut. And so defense companies go through attrition. When Republicans come in, defense budgets are lifted and boom. So I realized, you know what? I don't want somebody in the White House sort of deciding my fate. And so let me just go and get some skills. And so I went to, you know, went to UCLA to kind of hang out for a couple of years and kind of figure that stuff out. And I was just sitting in the cafeteria one day and just kind of shooting the crap with one of my colleagues from my class, second year of business school. I knew I did not want to work for a large company. And so I was thinking, okay, should I go do a startup, join a startup, what it is. This is 98, by the way. And so, this gentleman, Rob Assell, Rob said, hey, why don't you go and talk to Mattel? I said, Mattel? You know, what the hell would I do at Mattel? It's a large toy company. I Barbies, Hot Wheels, no, that's not my thing. He said, no. The chief strategy officer is this gentleman named Doug Glenn, who is an MIT product from the 60s, and he's trying to bring technology into toys of the future. I think you'll hit it off with him. So anyway, he made the introduction, and this was over, you know, a $2.95 garbanzo bean salad, because I looked for the cheapest thing. I was on complete financial aid. I'm like, what can I have that will give me some protein and not kill me? That was a garbanzo bean salad. And I went and met Doug, and Doug said, look, we've got a three-person shop, three different folks from MIT from three different eras, and you'd be the youngest of the bunch. And let's our charter is go travel, meet some really interesting technologists, and figure out how we can reinvent Mattel. And I said, mm-hmm. That's kind of cool. So it's like a startup within Mattel. And so that's what I ended up doing. And probably the claim to fame there was launching a joint venture with Intel, and we called it Intel Play. So Andy Grove wanted to get into the technology toy business. Jill Barad wanted to embed more technology into toys at Mattel. And so we called it Intel Play. So I parked myself in Hillsboro, Oregon, next to Intel. That's where our Skunk Works were. And we designed products and brought it to market in record time. It was just a remarkable experience.
Which one was your favorite?
So my favorite was a optical zoom microscope. By the way, I'm kicking myself because I never saved one. And so I may have to go out on eBay and pay for it. I don't know how much it costs and if they're around. We made about 300,000 of them. And the hardest thing, by the way, in the toy business, at least at that time, was you have to get the bill of materials down to $33 per unit. Because by the time you pay for it, it's up to 3x. So it has to be sold at $99 retail, which means right. The cost goods or the bill of material has to be 33. And how do you get electronics and optics and housing and packaging and all that stuff for $33? That was a challenge that I was assigned to, and I made it work. So
wow,
that's the one that I love. And you could actually have time-lapse photography. So one of the use cases, interestingly enough, was kids wanted to use the sunlight to fry bugs, and use the magnification of the optics to kill little bugs and actually record it. This was before social media, before anything, so you don't have these viral videos going crazy, but that was at least a use case we hadn't anticipated, but became one of the more common ones. So it brought my MIT sort of technology background and taught me a ton about the CPG business, the consumer products business here in the US.
Okay, we're gonna try a very impromptu segment here. With the eight ball in your hand, magic eight ball in your hand, we'd like to ask it a few questions.
Okay.
Based on the answer, we'd like for you to agree or disagree and give a very brief explanation as to why.
Okay, hold on. I'm still struggling to figure out how to open the darn thing.
Okay.
I'm assuming it's a screw on and off. That's the either that or it has to be, you know, this is like opening the peanut bag on a Southwest Airlines. It took me 45 minutes once. Just to be able to do that. And by the time I did, I was so frustrated, the damn peanuts went all over the place. But being the optimist, I said, at least I got it done. So anyway.
It's just fascinating to me that someone who fixed the Hubble telescope.
Yes, yeah. is struggling to open the eight ball.
Is struggling to open the eight ball.
Yes.
To be fair, I feel like packaging has gotten to like this next level where you just can't get anything open anymore. Like they're using industrial glue and tape and you're like, you need like a machete to open your Amazon package.
You know what's infuriating? It's the ties, the plastic ties that are so minuscule that you can't even get a scissor in crevice to cut them. I think it's the most ridiculous thing. And if I worked at Mattel or any of these toy manufacturers, I would just be like, look, let's really just calm down on the packaging. Can we just dial it back a little bit, please?
By the way, I made Peloton aware of a design flaw. As successful as that company is, there's a very, very simple sort of design flaw that's there. And my patience, by the way, is being tested, even though I'm a very patient person. But the design flaw is as follows. If you have a Peloton, where you take the cord from the power socket and plug it into the back of the bike, there's an LED, there's a white LED light. Now, even if you don't have it inserted all the way through, the light stays on, because all it's telling you is that power is flowing from the socket. Mm. What it doesn't tell you is that it's actually connected to the bike. And it requires a little bit of a push to actually have the port connect. Now, my suggestion to the gentleman on the other side of the customer support line was do one of two things. Either don't turn the light on until the connection is made, one, or have two lights where it goes from green to white or white to green, saying that, hey, you have power, so don't worry about that, but it's not fully plugged in. And that will, solve the issue. So anyway, he was very thankful.
Wow.
I told him, as and when you make that change, please give me some credit for that. And he said he'll make the CEO aware of it. So
how much time do you spend calling customer service of companies and giving them suggestions?
Especially if it's around things that, as a consumer, by the way, I feel like it would just help them and they should know about. I mean, ideally, if it's a startup, for example, so I always give business to startups, right? So I had a house where there was a company that was doing this sort of next generation rental management thing. And I was one of their first customers. I was like, okay, go ahead and do it. And then I sat them down and did a day-long strategy session saying, these are all the issues that I ran into as I was being onboarded and as and when people were getting in touch with me. So they've actually embedded those into their next version and then raise a ton of money. So that's good. That's great. And I'm happy for that.
You need a CNBC show like Mojo, startup consultant.
I love technology. And And I've made enough mistakes over my lifetime, both on the tech side and in terms of startups that I've backed, they've made some mistakes that I just, if I see that flaw, I just feel compelled rather than just letting it be, you know, linger. I'll figure out a way to get to, you know, somebody. And to Peloton's, you know, I need to commend them on that. When I call customer support, I mean, they answered right away rather than a typical bank or insurance company or whatever, where you'd be on call, you know, hold for an hour and a half. And of course they'll call you back, but just when they call you back is when you've just gotten on another call. So you miss the cycle and the day is gone. So I do give them credit. Guys, I have to admit, I'm very honest that way. I am not able to open the eight ball.
Well, look, I know the eight ball isn't working. How about if we run through the questions and you give us a quick yes or a no? Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. The first question, will Iron Pillar have a unicorn in the next 5 years?
Absolutely, yes.
Do you want to give away which company you believe it will be?
So, you know, being an Indian, I'll give you buy one, get one free. So there are two companies in our portfolio that are doing remarkably well, especially in the pandemic. One is a consumer play. The other one is a cloud software play. The consumer play is a company called Fresh to Home. It's fresh, as the name implies, fish, poultry, and produce to your doorstep. So they, you know, they catch the fish or you know, the fish is caught at 3-4 in the morning, and within 24 hours, it's cleaned, packaged, and at your doorstep without any preservatives, et cetera, et cetera. So it's become a habit-forming sort of company in India and increasingly the Middle East. They just raised $121 million that they announced last month. So mega round, big company. And Sean, the guy who built it, was the head of Zynga. And he sort of, you know, in a fun way says, my only experience with fish was actually creating a fish game as part of Farmville or something like that at Zynga, you know, but his co-founder comes from fishing and the family business. So that's one on the consumer side. On the enterprise side, we have a company that's an IIT Madras, now called Chennai, spin out, which is now a Palo Alto headquartered company called Unifor, which does conversational AI and analytics for call centers and customer support centers. So it's exactly the thing that we're talking about. How does the agent know the sentiment? How do they leverage AI to resolve queries, to escalate to the superiors, et cetera, to cut down your time to resolution and increase the customer satisfaction score? So that's a company that is quadrupling their ARR this year and will be, anyway, they've got a lot of inbound interest for what we think will be an interesting interesting milestone in the coming weeks. So I'll just leave it at that. But both of these companies, I think, definitely in the next five years, hopefully sooner, will achieve that that status.
Well, just so you know, I went online and I found a virtual eight ball and I asked that virtual eight ball the same question and it said, you may rely on it.
There you go.
So... we're getting an affirmative from the magic eight ball.
That's right.
Now, will Mattel get the customer service AI so that you can call them and tell them that you can open the eight ball?
I think they should just have something right on here that says, press here.
You know? Press here. Absolutely.
It's like a prescription bottle. Yeah.
All right. Lightning round.
Yes.
Will you restart your semi-pro dart throwing career?
I am definitely going to be throwing darts. I don't know if I'm going to go semi-pro with it. But, you know, I'm not a kite surfer like a lot of my VC brethren. I don't do 4 a.m. ice baths and body hacking. But I win in horseshoes and darts because both of those you can actually throw while you're sipping single malt at the same time. And so that's about the only thing where I can double, you know, I can multitask. So yes, I will be putting my Viper dartboard up in the next 24 hours and get back to throwing darts soon.
And Virtual 8-Ball says signs point to yes. So confirmed by the 8-Ball. Sounds like you're 2 for 2.
Confirmed.
Thank you, 8-Ball. Yes.
Will your blog, which for all of the viewers and listeners out there, called Jolly's Volleys, go viral and make you famous?
That is not what I'm looking for, but if anyone is interested in learning about my fun experiences in India, please go and read Jolly's Volleys. It'll put a smile on your face. Because I called it, you know, discovering India through the lens of a VC. And so, you know, I am too American for Indians and I'm too Indian for Americans sometimes. So I'm sort of a misfit on both sides. But there's some really, really fun experiences that I tried to sort of coalesce and write about, which again, taught me a little bit about India, about the way people think, and about the way, you know, the entrepreneurs think. So I'm not looking for fame, by the way. That's not my ethos. But heck, if you know, somebody wants to share and have it go viral, I'm not going to complain.
Virtual 8-Ball says, cannot predict now. We don't know.
That's a typical VC answer, by the way. It's not a yes or a no. It's a definite maybe. So.
And the Virtual 8-Ball is really undefeated. It's 4 for 4.
It really is.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Awesome.
So I think we'd like to end this podcast and this episode on a sweet note. And with that, we'd like for you to open up the last box.
Oh, I know what this is. I know what this is. Okay. For everybody out there, it's a little place called Kabila. It's an Indian, North Indian restaurant and takeout place. And I think I know what this is. Especially if you've told me it's sweets. My favorite sweet is something called jalebi. And I think that's what this is, if I'm not mistaken.
If you were going to describe jalebi and what it means to you, to the listeners and viewers out there.
It is the absolute polar opposite of what we started this podcast with, which was all about biohacking and how to prolong life and, you know, how do you do that? This is the antithesis. So it's three of my favorite food groups: sugar, butter, and dough or flour, deep fried. This should have a warning on it, by the way. It should just say, you know, only chew a little bit at a time. You cannot have the entire amount. But it's my, what should I say? If I have a late night, if I'm, you know, down for some reason, this will lighten my mood. And the way I like to imbibe, or I guess take this, is you heat up milk and you dip the jalebi in the milk, let it sort of soak the milk in. The milk gets sweeter. So when you drink the milk, it's sweet. And then at the end of it, you split the jalebi into small pieces and eat it. And I'm salivating. You know, between the single malt and the jalebi, I mean, my dinner is here. I mean, I'm overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed. This is tremendous. This is tremendous. Thank you so much. And then, you know, all of you have to come over, by the way. There's no way I'm going to finish this. And I'm not going to allow my family to finish it, because it's just way too much sugar and all that good stuff.
Which shot glass would you give to me and Vic if we were to come over out of your 350 shot glass collection?
So I think I have two. I have a wooden shot glass. It's a sake glass that I got from a Japanese village. And one of the elders gave it to me. Now, I don't know if he was telling the truth or not. It's something that had been handed down or had a particular design. So that's one. And the other one is a pewter shot glass that I got from a pewter factory in Malaysia. which actually is one of my favorite pieces. So you guys come over and you can decide who wants the Japanese sake glass and who wants the Malaysian pewter. But those would be the two that I'll be honored to serve you in.
Fantastic. So we're going to let you go enjoy the jalebi with the warm milk. But before we do, there's still a little bit of Macallan 18 left in your glass.
Yes.
And as customary, or we're trying to make customary on our podcast, we love for you to take us out with a toast. This is your time to, and do what you want with it. This is your 2 minutes.
Yeah, look, so first of all, I can't thank you guys enough for giving me this opportunity. And the way I want to leave this is, on a positive note, okay? This year, 2020, has been a very difficult one for the entire world. There's still a lot of turmoil that is going on. And in March, I had written a blog, which I called "Hindsight Will Always Be 2020." So it was a play on the number on the words. And I said two things as an optimist, right? So one is the world is indeed united like never before because we're fighting a common enemy. The irony is an enemy we cannot see. The virus. And so that's one. The second, though, is I'm not a big fan of the term social distancing. And so I coined a new term, which I call virtual proximity, which means that thanks to tools like we're using right now, it's actually given us an opportunity to connect with friends, family, loved ones, and others. And in my case, I've used the last several months to connect with people that I may have lost touch with 20, 30 years ago. And almost every one of those has welcomed me back into their lives and said, my goodness, even though 2020 has been a tough one, we're just so glad that we have reconnected as a result. So use virtual proximity and hopefully, we all shall meet in 3D as a friend of mine told me. So here's to you, here's to, 2021. And getting through this, and getting closer as humanity, as people. So, thank you again. Cheers.
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 Wow. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for agreeing to come on. And it's just been such a pleasure to talk to you. I was so excited when you said yes. Because for me, it's like a bye, right? Like an Indian brother, older brother that you look up to, you see a lot of yourself in and people who molded me in the way that I think and the way that I act. And so to be able to ask you questions and to get this time with you is really special.
No, likewise, it's been a pleasure. It's been an honor. Thank you for these amazing, amazing gifts. And I hope that I get to enjoy them, with all of you at some point in the near future. So thank you. Thank you.
Cheers.